Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with the Kia dealers of Ireland. Wherever the next 7 years bring you, Kia are with you all the way.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock. I want to go straight now to Jack Clark. Jack, good afternoon to you.
Good, a very good afternoon to you, Katie. How are you?
Good. And how are you, Jack? Because it's just 2 days now past your mam's first anniversary, Marion Finucane's first anniversary.
Yeah, it's obviously been a very strange year for us all. You know, with the virus and everything, we've been kind of separated from home. I live in the UK, so I haven't been able to see Dad as much as I would have liked this year. And obviously, we had my daughter was born very soon after Mam died. So, with the plan, you know, was always that we would spend a lot of time with each other this year. But unfortunately, it wasn't to be.
Because
so it's been a strange old year.
Yeah, to say the least, I'm sure. And that the fact that your daughter arrived would have been Marion's first grandchild just 5 weeks after she passed. Such a heartbreaking, you know, the timing of that is so heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah. Very sort of bittersweet, I suppose, when Sinead was born. You know, my dad has, you know, he has a couple of grandkids, but Sinead would have been my mother's first, and she was very much looking forward to being a grandmother herself. And my mother-in-law, Linda, had been, you know, emailing back and forth saying about how they're going to be glamorous grannies together. And, you know, Linda was kind of saying how wonderful it is to be a grandparent. And I think Mam was really, really looking forward to it. So, you know, for her to pass just before Sinead was born is obviously devastating for us, and even for Sinead not to know who her grandmother was, you know, is very sad for us all. But such is life, you know. And 5 weeks after Mam died, we were blessed with a little girl. So, you know, it's been bittersweet, I suppose, is the best word to describe it. Lots of love in the family, and lots of really happy moments. But always kind of in the back of our mind is, you know, there's someone missing.
That sadness, yeah. And you called your little girl Sinead, and that was a big decision for you, something you wouldn't have done if your mother had still been alive.
Well, yeah, so we didn't know if we were going to have a boy or a girl. I think, you know, given my sister Sinead had died when she was 8 years old, I think it would have been far too close to the bone to name a daughter Sinead if Mam was around. But when she died, you know, myself and my wife Jennifer, we talked about it, and we thought it was a nice tribute to both my sister and my mum, you know, that the legacy be carried on in the name, I suppose.
I think, and we're talking today not just because it's the anniversary, but because this documentary on your mother, Marion, is going to be broadcast on RTE television.
That's
this
right.
Evening. And I've actually had a chance to have a preview of that documentary. And when your father, John, talks about this sadness, this tragedy at the heart of your family, the loss of Sinead, clearly your mother really, in his words, never really recovered from that tragedy.
No, I think, you know, for any parent to lose a child is probably the worst thing that can happen to you.
You would have been, sorry, Jack, but you would have been very young when this was unfolding within the family, wouldn't you?
Yeah, so I was 4 when Sinead died. She was 8, I was 4. So, you know, she was being treated. She got the very best treatment she could get at the time. And in many ways, if she had caught leukemia maybe 5 or 10 years later, they probably would have been able to cure it. But we just didn't really have the science, I suppose, at that time. And hopefully, you know, the treatment that Sinead underwent probably went on to help other kids who came after. But no, I think, you know, because my mother was very much a stalwart, and she never really wanted to miss work. So she actually worked all the way through Sinead's illness, and her and my dad kind of did split shifts on going into the hospital when Mam was working, and vice versa. The other one would you know, they would split the day in two. And then, obviously, unfortunately, Sinead passed, and I think, you know, Mam carried that very close to her all her life, really, and was never, you know, it was not really a topic that we could bring up without a few tears being shed. And I think, you know, she was very guarded publicly about her private life. And I think she knew that if that was a topic that came up, that, you know, she wouldn't be able to hold back the tears. So she always tried to avoid that as a topic of discussion.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary feat for her to be able to come into a studio like I'm sitting in now and professionally present a radio programme, knowing that she was facing into, you know, going to her daughter's sickbed and that, you know, knowing the grief that followed on from that. It was really an extraordinary achievement that she kept it all together and kept the show on the road despite what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of who she was, though. She had a very, very good work ethic, and she believed that the work she was doing was important. And although, you know, she was experiencing tragedy in her own life, you know, the world keeps spinning and the sun keeps rising, so you have to keep on going. And you know, that's kind of a work ethic that she carried on all the way through her life. So she would often go, you know, into work when other people might call in a sick day or something like that, but that wasn't really part of her vocabulary.
What really comes across really strongly in the documentary is the extraordinary relationship that your parents enjoyed, that bond between your dad, John, and Marion was really extraordinary and endured over those 40 years.
Yeah, I think that, you know, they're very lucky in a sense that they met each other. You know, they're both married before, and particularly, I think, at that time in Ireland, it would have been, you know, very much frowned upon to be, you know, remarried or to get into another relationship. But they're just very lucky. You know, they're well suited to each other. They both loved reading. They both loved travelling, and you know, there was they kind of scratched the intellectual curiosity that the other one had, and they would be just as happy sitting reading their books in total silence as they would be debating, you know, whether black was white or vice versa. So, yeah, they had a great relationship, and you know, I'm certainly very lucky to have seen that and been part of that.
Your father actually, in one section of the documentary, said he can't actually remember an argument. Now, I suppose we all half forget the some of the arguments we have to, but that does seem to be exceptional.
Yeah, well, I mean, you'd have to talk to him about that. I think every couple probably has an argument every now and again. It's human nature. But, you know, I certainly don't really remember big arguments. And I suppose when someone very close to you dies, you don't really think of the bad times. You try and focus on the good times, and thankfully there were plenty of those. So I think in the whole, you know, Dad can look back on it and be very happy that you know, they kind of found a counterpoint in each other, and they supported each other. You know, they didn't always see eye to eye in terms of their worldview, or, you know, whatever the topic of the day might have been. They might have taken opposing views. They loved to debate, but by and large, they were mad about each other.
Tell me what it was like growing up as Marion Finucane's son. And what was the house? You know, was there a radio on in every room? Was there the house full of newspapers and current affairs chat all the time, or was that something that was left for work?
No, very much so. That was a big part of my life. You know, you'd have RTÉ News on in the kitchen, and maybe BBC News on in another room, and CNN on in the telly room. And, you know, we would sit and talk for hours about what was going on in the world, or, you know, the politics of the day, or whatever it might have been. You know, I think that's something she probably passed on to me, and something that was very much alive in our household, was this kind of thirst for information and trying to get to the truth of an issue, or you know, find a definitive opinion on something. So, I mean, from my perspective, I loved it. You know, it was great to be included in these sorts of things. I'd often probably pester them to come in late at night when they were having dinner parties, so I could listen or throw in my two cents. And, you know, more often than not, they'd probably let me in for a while before booting me out to bed. But, no, it was great. And some of the characters that were around the house as well, down through the years, even Patrick and Kate, you know, the producers of this show tonight, were a big part of our life. You know, it's great that in many ways that it was them that got to make this documentary, because they knew our family so well. And they knew kind of what made Mam tick, and you know, that kind of enthusiasm, I suppose, for what was going on in the world, and, you know, what your role was in the world, and, you know, if you could influence it and try to be a force of good, well, then you kind of had a responsibility to do so.
I wonder as well, though, is there some pressure from, you know, maybe your school friends or people outside of the home when they find out your mother is somebody as you know, famous and such a big figure as Marion Finucane?
I don't know if it's pressure. I think, you know, Mam did a very good job, I think, of shielding her family from the spotlight, very much so. I think, you know, as a young fella, I probably... I don't know, I probably booked when people said, you know, this is Marion Finucane's son. I kind of wanted to be recognised on my own merits. And then as you get older, you realise how silly you were. But no, it was always generally very positive. You know, people up and down the country had just great stories. And even after she died, you know, some of the stories that you would hear about how, you know, she touched people's lives, or, you know, she helped people, or there was an influence there. And it's. I don't think it's a pressure. I actually think it's a great privilege, really, to have a mother who has such a positive impact on people.
Yeah, and indeed, I was actually in this chair when your mom did pass, and we had a program where so many people called in, just to people who would never have met her personally, but just the impact her. The work she did had on their lives, and how, you know, moments and times stayed with them forever, and they were, you know, anxious to tell those stories.
Yeah, I think so. I think, I mean, like on a slightly more lighthearted note, my mother was quite tall. She was like 5'10", probably 5'10" in heels, certainly. But you know, she would. Often people would come up to her and say, you know, oh, you're much taller than I thought you were, which we used to always fall around the place laughing with, because, you know, what does a tall person sound like? But, you know, everyone up and down the country, wherever we went, you know, we were often greeted with a smile, and, you know,
how did she find that? How did you find that, Jack? When people approached her, because my sense of her was that she, you know, she was a private, you know, shy enough person. How did she kind of deal with people approaching her, you know, on the street, or
well, she definitely was a private person, you know, and she would mind her P's and Q's when she was talking to someone in the street, because you never know, you know, one bad interaction and the next thing it's in the papers or it's on Twitter or whatever. So she was always very careful to, you know, be polite and be mannerly, but fundamentally, you know, she believed that people were good. So often, you know, a big smile and how are you, and a few questions about who they were and where they came from. And it was all, she dealt with it very well, I thought. Well, that was my experience of it whenever I was there. And, you know, I think sometimes she might have found it a little bit awkward when she didn't know what to say, as we all do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she dealt with it very well. And by and large, you know, people were really nice to her. So, well, certainly to her face. So, you know, you never had any arguments or any issues in that sense. So it was usually fairly positive.
Take me back then to one of your last trips as a family, was to this wedding in Mumbai in India.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of a remarkable story, really, because it echoes back further back in our family, in the sense that many years ago, Mom and Dad went over to India and did an on-video interview with Indira Gandhi. And I think it was actually one of the last English language video interviews that she did, which isn't bad for, you know, a young one from Glasnevin. But she got the interview in the can, and then Dad and she went travelling around India. And their trip was called short because Dad got the call to say that his mother was very unwell and that they'd have to go back. So most of my life, you know, they were always talking about how they had unfinished business in India and they really wanted to go back. And, you know, there was places that they wanted to explore and that sort of thing. So fast forward to the modern day, and a very good friend of mine, James Robinson, who lives over in Vancouver, fell in love with an Indian lady, and the prospect of an Indian wedding was on the cards, and, you know, we were all really, really excited about this and talking about it really probably before James had even popped the question. But when the opportunity did come around, you know, they booked their tickets early, and they were certainly keen, reading all the books about places that they were going to go and where they're going to explore and that sort of thing. And then, you know, my wife Jenny was you know, heavily pregnant at the time, and so there was a bit of negotiation there for me to get to go over. In fact, I kind of said at the time I could have given Michelle Barnier a few tips on how to negotiate with Brits, because it was touch and go there. But eventually, thankfully, I was able to travel with them, and we went over, and just this wedding was just so spectacular. I don't know if you've ever been to an Indian wedding, but it's like nothing you've ever seen before. It's the scale of it and the colours and the dancing and all this. So it was a remarkable trip, really. And so many happy memories. We were over there for Christmas. And then on the 29th, I think, of December, I kissed her goodbye and said, you know, the next time I see you, you'll have a granddaughter. And I went off, and she flew back to Ireland the next day. And unfortunately, she never got to meet her grandchild, but we certainly had lots of really, really good memories from that trip. And I'm forever grateful, really, that we do, because if that wasn't the case, you'd probably be racking your brains to think, you know, what were the last conversations you had, or this, that and the other. But as it stands, we have great memories and some great pictures. And so, yeah, it was the trip of a lifetime in many respects. And then, obviously, that strange parallel between Dad being called back when his mother, was unwell, and then me having to go back when Mom died as well. It's just very, very strange.
And there was, because you were in Goa, you had decided to stay on, as you say, and you were in Goa. Were they able to reach you with this news?
So it was a bit tricky. The line wasn't very good, so it was kind of this awkward thing where we'd been calling, lots of missed calls, and then the line would break and stuff like that. So that, in that respect, it was quite awkward. And then I was out there with a couple of schoolmates who were, you know, just amazing for me. They rallied around me and kind of took care of me. And then I flew back as soon as I could. And my wife picked me up from Heathrow. And, of course, you know, she was nearly ready to pop with the baby. She was really pregnant, so she had to get a letter from the doctor to say that she was able to travel over to Ireland. And then we flew over that evening and went straight home, and then we could be together as a family one last time.
Yeah, I just, you hear these stories when people are abroad and they get that phone call you never want to get. And that trip home must have been very, very difficult, you know, that long flight back.
It was a tough one, I have to say. One slightly kind of humorous story from it was, I had booked, I'm also quite tall like my mother, and I'd booked an exit seat on the flight back. And when I got down to the seat, you know, there was this kind of old granny sitting in my seat, and I kind of pointed at my ticket saying, you know, that's my seat. And she basically told me in sort of half Indian, half English that she wasn't moving. So I just thought I wasn't really in the mood for an argument. So I sat down in another seat, and as the flight took off, I think I was probably crying and shedding a few tears, and I could see this woman looking over at me going, jeepers, I should have just given him the seat, you know. Obviously she didn't know what was going on, but yeah, it was a horrible trip back. But when I got home, then, you know, there's nothing kind of more important than being surrounded by your family at that stage, so that was a good thing.
And I suppose not just, you know, obviously missing out on that, you know, becoming a grandmother is obviously huge. But also, as your dad talks about in this documentary, they had decided that Marion was not going to renew her contract and that she was going to retire. And she was just weeks away from finally having that time. And obviously she was thinking to spend with her new grandchild. It's just very cruel that after, you know, a lifetime of dedicated work, that this was taken from her.
Yeah, I think so. I think she loved her work. You know, she loved being on the radio. She loved being part of the national discussion. And, you know, she would work ever so hard throughout the week so that she was well prepared on the weekend for her show, you know. So I think actually she probably would have found retirement quite difficult because, you know, what do you do? And we had talked as a family about different things, you know, different documentary projects we could have worked on, or perhaps she could try and go and do some lecturing, or maybe go back and even study herself, because she did have a, you know, an insatiable thirst for information. And then, of course, you know, being a grandmother was going to be a big part of that. And from our perspective, you know, we really looked forward to the fact that she was going to be a big part of our kids' lives. But it wasn't to be. And so, you know, we just have to do our best to make sure that our kids know who their grandma was. And that's all we can do, I think.
Indeed, yeah. And of course, she was the person who made this programme, that was the first person to sit in this seat and who
made
this programme, the National Institution it now is. I think, looking back, did she have a favourite programme or a favourite time in her career, or was it all just part of the journey for her?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think that's kind of like asking which is your favourite child, you know. I think they all had different meaning for her. I think the Women Today show was really kind of a peak of her activism, I suppose, when, you know, she felt like she was maybe breaking down barriers or breaking through glass ceilings or breaking something. And then, of course, Liveline was great because you just get that element of live radio where you don't really know what's going to happen. And you hope that you and your team can line up a good enough show that you get a few interesting nuggets out of it. And thankfully, you know, more often than not, she was able to do that. And then, of course, she moved to the morning after Gabe Byrne. And that in itself was probably, for her, I think, a great achievement. I think she was very, very proud of the fact that she got that slot. And then as time moved on, you know, she often referred to various conversations that she'd had with her mentors where they said, you know, the weekend radio was at that time, you know, the graveyard shift. Effectively, no one really listened to the radio on the weekend. And she thought that there was a good gap there to try and, you know, put out really good content that people could listen to on their walk or when they're in the hair salon or when they're in their kitchen, and that would keep people interested and keep people up to date. So in many respects, that last project was just as important to her because she had a point to prove. But as I say, you know, she was born to broadcast. She started off life as an architect, and I think when she took to the continuity announcing first and then onto broadcasting proper, she definitely found her vocation. And I think, you know, the documentary tonight will show sort of that evolution in her a little bit.
Yeah, there is just fascinating archive taking you right back to those early days. Well, clips of Marion as a continuity announcer, but then into the women's programme and all the way through, when you kind of get a sense of the span of social history that her career encapsulated.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, it's one of those things as she kind of became more... I suppose her voice was more recognised and her name was out there a little bit more. She, you obviously inevitably get, you know, the bigger interviews and the really exciting stuff of the current affairs of the day. And I think, you know, and I'm sure you can probably relate to, you, as a presenter, you're always trying to get the best possible guests on. And when you get a good one, there's a buzz around the team. And, you know, and even at home, she would, or when I was over here, she'd call me up and say, "Look, I think we're going to get such and such this weekend." And
so the excitement,
you know,
never
about what they've done. The light never went out. You know, she loved it. It was definitely her passion. And you know, I think if she could have lived and worked till 100, you know, it still would have been very tough for her to retire completely from that element of it. And I think had she lived on, she might have got involved in more kind of documentary style projects, or, well, who knows, you never know. But I think that's probably the direction of travel she might have been thinking about. But
Can I ask you about the documentary that is airing tonight? Was there a discussion within the family about taking part in that documentary and cooperating with that documentary so soon after your mother's passing? Was that a difficult decision?
It's a good question, I suppose. I think, you know, if we go back to the funeral and, you know, there were a lot of people at the funeral, and there was TV cameras at the funeral and press at the funeral, and you kind of, you have to accept, you know, that although she was our mother and kind of the matriarch of our family, but she was a lot more to a greater number of people, and you part share her in some ways with the public life that she had. So it was probably inevitable that someone would want to make a program at some point. And when the prospect of Patrick and Kate doing this came up, you know, myself and Dad had a chat about it, and it just seemed like they were definitely the most appropriate people because they knew her so well. So we thought that they would definitely get the essence of what she was about. And, you know, yes, it was very close to her passing. But I think that, you know, if we didn't do it like that, you'd run the risk of a total stranger making a show. And then, you know, Dad talks throughout this documentary, and I don't know if he would have been as comfortable with someone he didn't know. And the fact that he's known Patrick and Kate since God was a child means that he was comfortable talking about things that otherwise he probably wouldn't. So, I think both Dad and myself are very grateful to Patrick and Kate for the show that they've made, and also, I suppose, the compassion that they showed and the space that they allowed Dad in making the show.
Yeah, because I think it's what comes across very, very strongly is how lost, really, your dad has felt at your mother's loss and at the relationship that, you know, that I suppose was taken for granted for all those years, and how he's struggling to cope.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. You know, you lose your partner of 40 years. It's like losing your right arm, I suppose. And then on top of that, the fact that because of the virus, you're not allowed to see your loved ones, or you know, even just kind of run away somewhere for a while, or you know, you're confined to the house that you lived in together, and you're looking at the pictures that you took together. It must have been very, very tough on him. And you know, again, he's very lucky in the sense that we've got great neighbours in the community who've rallied around and, you know, got his shopping for him when he wasn't allowed to go out, and you know, knock in and make sure that he's okay and stuff like that. And you know, they'll never make him feel 100% better, but they certainly made life a little bit more bearable for him.
I was struck. Sorry, Jack, to cut across you there, but I was just struck by what he said about Sinead's grave, that your mom could never bring herself to visit the grave, whereas your father always said hello to Sinead, didn't have that problem, but hasn't been back since your mother was buried with her.
Yeah, and I think, you know, grief probably manifests itself in different ways in different people. And, you know, I don't think there's a right or wrong way to grieve someone that you love. You can only really kind of look after yourself and deal with it as best you possibly can, you know. And I think that we would go down to Sinead's grave normally around the 18th of August. And, you know, that would always be a tough one for Mam. There would always be a lot of tears and, you know, we would rally around as a family. And then, you know, Dad would be up and down the road the whole time anyways going past, and he probably, you know, that was his coping mechanism. I think he was always going to be her little, or she was always going to be his little girl. So it's tough. You know, you don't know how you're going to deal with it until it happens to you, I think.
And very tough on you as well. As you say, you can't just pop in to home to, you know, chat with your dad now that you because of the situation we find ourselves in, you don't have the same support systems around you either, do you?
No, I can't go back, and that's, you know, that's part of the deal with COVID. But I've got you know, I've got a great wife and I've got good family back in Ireland who we talk to all the time, and you know, everybody's checking in on Dad as much as we possibly can, and we just kind of look forward to the day that, you know, we can get vaccinated and, you know, we can sit around the table again and you know, try and get some sort of normality back in our lives. We thought, you know, because there was such an air of sadness after Mam died, and she was generally such a kind of a positive person, that we should have a party in her honour. And, you know, that obviously never happened and couldn't happen last year. And the hope is that someday soon, in the not too distant future, that we can get all the friends and family down to Kildare again for a party, and we celebrate her life and turn it into something a little bit more positive.
Absolutely. Jack, do you want to stay on the line for one moment? I just have a caller in who wanted to talk about the time your mom interviewed himself and his late wife. Pat Murphy, good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody.
Pat, you have a memory you want to share of
Marion. I have a great memory of Marion interviewing us. Just before, in 1999, my late wife Olivia and I were interviewed by Marion just prior to we setting off on our planned sailing around the world, circumnavigation on it. It was the most easiest interview. Now, I've done interviews and everything else, but Marion was so, so nice and made you feel at ease the whole time on it. And I remember the reaction after it from around the country was unbelievable, with people listening to it and enjoying it. And I remember we eventually left Ireland at Kilmore Quay, and we headed across to Padso in Cornwall, a favourite spot of ours. And we were in there, and we were only in. Now, we'd mentioned on the interview that when we were going there, or roughly when we'd be in Padso, and a man turned up and he says, "Pat and Olivia, I heard your lovely interview on the radio with Marion Finucane." And that was in Cornwall. It was, I'll never forget that interview. And she was so, so lovely to work with. And I was very sad to hear of her passing earlier on last year on it. And I listened to her every week. Every time she was on, I listened to her. And, yeah, so great memories of being interviewed by Marion Finucane.
Indeed. Pat Murphy, many, many thanks for calling in. Jack, that's you'll have had loads of Pats in the last year who will tell you that same story.
Well, it's certainly not too many people who've circumnavigated the world. I heard a story about when she went to the Aran Islands a few years ago, and she was walking down the road and some fellow was digging out his vegetable garden, and he heard the voice, obviously, and popped his head up over the wall and kind of look of surprise. He said, "Oh, it's you." And he dug out, I think, a couple of spuds and a turnip or something like that. And he insisted on giving them to her. And she was kind of saying, "No, that's your stuff. That's your food. Don't be giving it away." And he said that, you know, that the winters were very tough on the island, and that the weekends he looked forward to listening to her. And just when I heard that story, it kind of stopped me in my tracks, really. You know, just the effect that she had had on this guy. And, you know, I think her warm character touched a lot.
Okay, I think we just got the best out of that line. It's just gone us there. But I want to thank Jack Clark for sharing so much with us there. It's so lovely to talk to him about his mom, Marion Finucane. And that programme, Marion, is on air tonight on RTE1 at 9:35.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.